from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. With Proposition 19, which would legalize marijuana for a vote in the upcoming November 2nd election, there are still many questions that need to be answered about the health effects of recreational pot use and whether marijuana use impairs cognitive processes or causes addiction and increased side effects. We'll take all that up in the hour ahead, as well as whether or not legalizing pot would be apt to cause more traffic accidents. Forum is next with your calls, emails, and your online questions and comments. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Proposition 19, a November 2nd ballot measure, will allow California voters to vote in favor of or against legalizing marijuana in the state. We've already covered the proposition on forum, and you can listen to the arguments from both sides by going to our archives at kqed.org. But what about the health effects of recreational pot use and the nature of marijuana and addiction? What really do we know and what do we need to know? We're going to take all that up in this morning's forum hour with a couple of Bay Area physicians who will be joining us in studio. But first, we want to talk to Michael Montgomery, who's here with us in studio, reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch. And good morning, Michael Montgomery.
Good morning, Michael.
Well, I want to get up to date on this letter that went out from Attorney General Holder. And essentially what he said was, even if Proposition 19 passes in California, the feds are going to enforce things against marijuana.
That's right. I mean, in a sense, he was just restating current policy. But obviously, there's no coincidence with the timing of this letter. It was a letter that was a response to a letter sent to the Justice Department from nine former directors of the DEA. In essence, what he says is that the administration, Obama administration, opposes Prop 19. It will undermine efforts at going after major drug traffickers, endanger public safety. I think the most significant element is Attorney General Holder states that they will continue to vigorously enforce the Controlled Substances Act against those individuals or organizations that possess, manufacture, or distribute marijuana for recreational use. I think he's sort of throwing down the gauntlet there.
Well, and the timing, as you say, is significant. This is right before an election, and it's going to the heads of the DEA. Do they have the personnel, the feds? That's a big question in my mind. I mean, to enforce this beyond, say, the large-scale marijuana growers.
Well, it's unclear. Attorney General Holder didn't say what they'll actually do if Prop 19 passes. And I think we have to look at two layers. The proposition itself, as you've said, legalizes possession of less than an ounce and small-scale cultivation. What the feds are concerned about is a clause in the measure which would entitle cities and counties to legalize sales and large-scale cultivation. That's something that no other place in the world has ever done, and that, I think, is what this letter is really about.
And it's also about marijuana still being a Schedule I drug.
That's right. Marijuana is still considered classified as a Schedule I drug by the federal government alongside heroin, LSD. That goes back to the early 70s, and that is an issue for the federal government.
Michael Montgomery, again, is reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch, and thank you for updating us on this, Michael. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
Joining us in studio is Dr. Tim Mincermek. He's president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine. He's a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction and believes that marijuana is physically addictive, contrary to claims that have been made in the text of Proposition 19. Welcome, Tim Mincermek.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Dr. Larry Bedard is also with us, a Marin-based physician, former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He has endorsed Prop 19, and we welcome him this morning as well. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let me begin, Dr. Mincermek, with you, if I may. And let me begin by talking about, well, first of all, the California Society of Addiction Medicine has not taken a position on Prop 19. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And yet you're saying that there is dependency, and particularly in high doses, there is perhaps really serious concerns.
Well, there are two points. One is that there are several drugs that are legal, which are we become dependent to, tobacco, alcohol, even caffeine. So the fact that something is capable of creating dependence doesn't mean that it has to be illegal. But what I object to is that in the Proposition 19, right in the very first page, it has findings without any references, without any data, says that it's not physically addictive. And all the research that I've seen shows that simply is not true. There's multiple lines of research that show that there is an addictive potential.
Particularly for those who start smoking at a young age. I mean, I read some statistics, if they start smoking around 15, about 17% turn out to be, by at least your definition, addictive.
Well, it isn't my definition alone. It's within the diagnostic and statistical manual for marijuana dependence. But you're absolutely right. The data show that if you're 18 or older when you first start smoking marijuana, that upwards to about 9% will become dependent upon it at some point in their lives. That's not data just from the United States. That's from Australia. That's from New Zealand. So that's fairly well established, which means that 9 out of 10 people who start smoking at 18 or older will not ever become dependent on it. But if you start smoking it at earlier ages, and we're talking, say, about 15, 17% will become dependent upon it within 2 years. So there's a higher percentage and a more rapid dependence that develops among adolescents.
And the RAND report, not to necessarily go back to Proposition 19, but the RAND report that came out said it would essentially decrease the price, but it would increase use. If Prop 19 passed.
It says that the total consumption in California would go up about 58%. And it says that the number of people who are dependent upon marijuana in the state of California would increase by about 300,000, from 500,000 to a little bit over 800,000.
So even though you have not taken a position pro or con on Prop 19, more use means more cost for treatment because of the dependency or addiction that you've just cited, and that would mean perhaps an advocacy from your group, California Society of Addiction Medicine, for revenue for treatment, tax revenue for treatment.
Well, we think that any revenue that would come from this ought to go first for treatment. We have a problem here of, on the one hand, a yearning for civil liberties, and on the other hand, concern about any public health problems. And we don't know the degree of public health problems that may come about as a result of saying that it's harmless enough that adults can be using this legally. We don't know how adolescents are going to see that. And we clearly have to watch to see whether or not this does increase the use among adolescents, because that's the group where it has the most documented damage, both in terms of their education, in terms of their brain, in terms of their cognition.
Dr. Bedard, let's bring you to this. Again, Larry Bedard is a Marin-based physician, former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He's endorsed Prop 19. You're concerned about young people too, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. That's why Prop 19 was, I think, written to say that it's only legal to possess and use if you're 21 or older, much like alcohol.
But what about Prop 19 saying it's not addicted, or at least that's a lot of what the endorsements are saying?
Well, I had a discussion with Dr. Cermak before how you wanted to define addiction, because I think the way you defined addiction, I've got two daughters that are addicted. One's addicted to Facebook, and the other one's addicted to Twitter. And boy, when we were in Mexico and they didn't have access, they went through a real withdrawal syndrome. I think it's like caffeine, perhaps it's like tobacco. But as an emergency physician, I spent my career, the problem is alcohol addiction, in which there's a 5 to 10% mortality, causes seizures. Marijuana, I think, is like perhaps as addicting as coffee or tobacco. It does not have a serious medical withdrawal syndrome. People may get anxious. They may get craving. A lot of the other drugs, some legal, such as Valium and Xanax, they have serious withdrawal syndrome. And the most common cause of seizures in California in an ER is someone withdrawing from alcohol. So the comparison of alcohol to marijuana, very little similarities in the healthcare consequences.
I think the number of those who turned up in emergency rooms for help with marijuana was fewer than 200 over the past year or so.
Right. In 2008, the last year there was data, there was 181 people admitted to a hospital because of an adverse reaction to marijuana. That same year, there were 34,000, I think, 200 people admitted for acute medical problems due to alcohol. in my 25-year career in emergency departments in Northern California, I was at Marin General Hospital for 21 years, St. Mary's Hospital. I saw less than 10 people in my entire career who ever came to an emergency department for an adverse reaction to marijuana. By far, at least half of them were parents whose teenage son or daughter convinced them to share a joint, and then they went on to have anxiety reaction. Never had to admit a patient to a hospital in over 25 years in an emergency department.
I'm wondering how germane that is as far as you see things, Dr. Surmac, because you're shaking your head here.
Well, I'm shaking my head because how many people go to the emergency room because of tobacco smoking? I don't think that happens. And yet it kills over 400,000 people a year. So just looking at the number of people who go on an acute basis in an emergency room is not the best way to look at this. Also, the fact that it is addictive, you're absolutely right. It does not have a terrible withdrawal. There's a distinct withdrawal which has been defined, but people aren't jonesing in the gutter because they're withdrawing from marijuana. What they are doing is continuing to smoke in order to relieve the withdrawal symptoms of anxiety, insomnia, irritability, and so the fact that there is an addiction is in this case just something that leads people to continue using it.
Is it like Facebook or texting or?
I completely dislike anytime someone denigrates addiction by saying that it's like Facebook. What we know is that there's a reward center in the brain, that every drug of addiction leads to an increase in dopamine in that reward center, 10 to 15 times higher than anything you can do. That reward center is there so that when we have a meal, when we have sex, when we exercise, the dopamine level goes up and it leads us to repeat that beneficial behavior. Drugs of abuse will lead that dopamine to go up 10 to 15 times higher, ultimately changing the architecture of the cells in the reward center. And THC leads to just as high a rise in dopamine as all the other drugs of addiction.
This is an important distinction that Dr. Surmac makes and Dr. Bedard, I want your response to that, is between the neuroscience and the effects of THC as opposed to marijuana as a plant or some botanical phenomenon. And there is a distinction, certainly, isn't there? I mean, THC does have some pretty strong properties in it and consequences in it, and some of them unforeseeable.
Well, I wouldn't say, again, in 25 years in an emergency department, and I think emergency physicians are the specialists in acute drug abuse, it hasn't, less than 10 people. The average emergency physician, according to the number of people admitted in 2008, would only admit a patient once every 20 years. I mean, there's a lot of things that Dr. Surmac and I agree on. I don't think teenagers should be doing it. I think the same data holds up. If you start smoking cigarettes before the age of 12, the chance of you going to be smoking at 55 are very significant. Same thing with alcohol. The younger you drink, the more likely are that you're going to have a problem. I think the approach to that is legalize it, regulate it, put money into education, prevention and treatment.
But when Prop 19 people say it's not addictive or there are no adverse consequences, concern of people like Dr. Surmac is that they're propagating falsehoods.
Well, I don't know any drug or any substance you take in your body, including water, that can't have adverse consequences if you do too much of it. So I guess I, as a physician, it's kind of a risk-benefit which you look at, and I think the consequences are real in marijuana, but compared to all the other drugs that we use and abuse in the society, are relatively minor.
Well, in alcohol use, I believe it's about 80% of those who use alcohol use it responsibly. So, and roughly there's a parallel with cannabis or with marijuana use, I think, in terms of numbers. But Dr. Surmac, you've not taken a position, your group's not taken a position on Prop 19, and yet you conceded that there will probably be more use, as the RAND Corporation has pointed out. Doesn't that mean more traffic accidents, more impairment, more potential bad consequences?
Those are potential. The reason we haven't taken a stance on this is because there are legitimate arguments in both directions. There are the civil liberties arguments. We think that the heavy-handed enforcement that has at times incarcerated people who are really just ill from an addiction is absolutely the wrong way to go. So we don't know the right way to write laws. What we know is that we continually see, at this point, 16% of the people who are admitted for inpatient treatment of any drug dependence, 16% are there because of marijuana. So we see the people who are in trouble. And our position here is that we think the electorate needs to be voting from collective wisdom rather than collective ignorance. And so our position is to be educating people as much as possible about the fact that there are risks, the risks need to be managed, and the risks are greatest for adolescents.
What do you say, Larry Bedard, to that 16% figure you just heard cited?
He's the expert on addiction. I don't know the number. But one of the questions I would ask is how many of those were coerced into treatment? Now, I was a psychiatrist at the Navy Drug Rehab Center, lieutenant commander in the Navy, so I was on the front line in war on drugs. 30% of the Marines we saw in 1972 were faced with a decision. A judge in Alabama said 15 years in prison or 2 years, talk to the Marine Corps recruiter. So they talked to the Marine Corps recruiter. There's been a dramatic increase of 300% from 20,000 to 60,000 of people who get arrested for recreational use. When they then get arrested, a judge will say, if you go into a treatment program, we will completely eliminate any reference to this infraction or misdemeanor. So people are coerced. If you're halfway intelligent, you would take the option of participating, being coerced in some treatment program, as opposed to having this on your record, which would potentially make you ineligible for scholarships, ineligible for federal housing, such as a college dormitory, certain jobs, professions you couldn't get into. So you look at the number of people going into treatment, it exactly replicates the curve of the number of people who are arrested for recreational use.
Do you have a breakdown along those lines, Tim and Cermak? Coercion as opposed to the voluntary?
Well, first, everyone who goes into treatment is coerced, whether you're coerced by
your parents,
your spouse, your job. So no one goes in because they're happy to go there. One of the things that's been most interesting to me is to look at the fact that if you see people who are coerced by the law, by the courts, into treatment, their outcome from treatment is just as good as people who go in, quote, voluntarily, unquote. So we have found that forcing people into treatment at times is just as beneficial.
Well, let me ask you, Larry Bedard, about the long-term effects, because there has been some concern among those who are opposed to Proposition 19 and among many who are concerned about just the overall effects in the long term of marijuana that those with pre-existing conditions, for example, those with respiratory problems or the possibility of even irritating respiratory problems, these kinds of things become much more vulnerable. And if it does, if Prop 19 passes, the assumption, like the RAND Corporation says, we're going to have more use.
Well, speaking of more use, I think it's interesting that the maximum use occurred in 1979. In fact, it was about twice as high usage of marijuana in 1979 in California as it is now. You know, I believe probably the use will go up. 1979, contrary to Jerry Brown, I mean, we suddenly not every worker was, you know, stoned and we couldn't compete in the marketplace. So, yes, perhaps the use will go up.
And will that mean more traffic accidents? Is certainly a central question to many people about Prop 19. There have been some speculation it would increase possibly 2 to 3 times as many traffic accidents.
Well, I don't think the data would show that out. I mean, one of the problems with marijuana being a Schedule I drug, there's not a lot. There's only about 20 really reliable double-blind scientific studies. There's been thousands of other studies. They've done studies in Canada, for example, on driving courses. So I think when it becomes legal, you could define impairment much like alcohol at 6 to 7 nanograms per milliliter. what those studies show, obviously, the safest driver is somebody who is not under the influence of any drug. Then it goes up. If you're under marijuana, I think you maintain your judgment. You drive slower, but you have some impairment in eye-hand coordination or reaction time. Then alcohol, which I think they speed up because it impairs their judgment. In the worst-case scenarios, if you're drinking and smoking dope at the same time, that has the highest on, you know.
But you can test the alcohol much easier than you can the marijuana.
Well, you can actually test marijuana from saliva. If a parent wanted to do that, they could buy something on the internet for $348.
I'm thinking more about the police stops and those kinds of things.
But right now in California, when the police stop you, they have to show you're impaired. So that's why they give you a sobriety roadside. If you're not impaired, they can't legally take your blood from you. And same thing with marijuana. And, you know, the biggest drugs, some of the biggest drugs abuse are Oxycontin, Percodan, Vicodin, all legal, all prescribed by physicians. But, again, a police officer who's trained to look at impairment, you could be high and nothing other than Oxycontin, but if they find out and road test you're impaired, then they can draw a blood test and test for narcotics.
Well, as I said before, I don't necessarily want to get in another debate about Prop 19. We've already had that. It's in our archives, and it's certainly worth listening to for listeners who are interested. But what about long-term effects? How do you see things, Dr. Cermak? Again, the pre-existing vulnerabilities. You're talking about really the health risks where pot use is concerned or increased pot use is concerned.
Well, I disagree with people who say that we don't have much research on this. The research really has moved from the botany, from looking at marijuana, into the neuroscience. And so if you follow the research on neuroscience, then you start looking at the fact that we have what we call an endogenous, a natural cannabinoid system in our brain. It is the most common neurotransmitter in our brain is very similar to THC. THC just happens to mimic our natural cannabinoid chemistry. We have the receptor sites for that. And if you follow the research there, you begin seeing that the use of marijuana can lead to a diminishment of our receptor sites, our natural receptor sites in the brain, down to 20 to 60%, depending on which parts of the brain you're looking at. So the impact is not just the acute impact, but the impact is what's left over. And certainly in adolescence, we've seen that the very size of the hippocampus, the amygdala, certain parts of the brain are actually changed by chronic smoking.
Let's get a response from you, Dr. Bedard, and then we'll give out our phone number.
Well, yeah, let me answer on the medical question. I mean, as a physician, I would not endorse the smoking of any product, whether it's tobacco or marijuana. It's going to irritate your lungs. But they have done long-term studies on, like, Jamaican Rastafarians who have been smoking for 40 years and have found no increased incidence of lung cancer. A researcher at UCLA concluded it doesn't cause emphysema. It does cause chronic bronchitis. You know, if you're smoking cigarettes and you have chronic bronchitis or emphysema, I think marijuana would exacerbate that. You know, and I think that's what most of the studies have looked at is the chronic effect on smoking. And as far as we know, it does not cause cancer, does not cause emphysema, may cause chronic bronchitis.
Well, let me invite our listeners. I'm sorry, Dr. Cermak, quickly, if you could.
I think Bedard is correct about that in terms of what the data shows us. But how long did it take us with tobacco to come to a proof that it caused cancer?
Let me give out the phone number because I know there are many of you who are listening who want to weigh in here. We're talking really about the health effects of recreational pot use and use of marijuana, not only in terms of short-term but long-term effects. And these are big questions, and if you do want to weigh in, we welcome your phone calls. It's toll-free. You can join us whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite at 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free number for your calls, and you can call us now, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. We talked with Michael Montgomery before, reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch. And now we have with us here in studio Dr. Timon Cermak and Dr. Larry Bedard, and your calls and emails and postings when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. California voters are going to consider on November 2nd whether or not to legalize marijuana, and we're discussing the health effects of recreational pot use. We have discussed Proposition 19 before on Forum, and Timon Cermak is with us. He belongs to the California Society of Addiction Medicine, of which he's president, and in fact they have not taken a position on Prop 19, but he is concerned about the physical addiction of marijuana and says that there are claims in the text of Prop 19 that essentially say that it is not physically addictive. He's a psychiatrist and specializes in addiction. Dr. Larry Bedard is also with us this morning here in studio, and he's a Marin-based physician, former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He endorsed Proposition 19 and has endorsed it. Michael Montgomery was with us earlier, who is, of course, a reporter for KQED Radio News and California Watch, and who reported on Attorney General Eric Holder's statement that whether Prop 19 passes or not, the federal government will continue to enforce marijuana use and marijuana growing and development. Let me go to our first caller who's joining us from Wichita Falls, Texas. Penny, good morning.
Yes, I just can't believe that they're ignoring the fact that marijuana definitely is a gateway drug. And just because you make it legal for adults, you will not keep it out of the hands of juveniles. This proven with alcohol and other adult drugs and adult activities. Also, the pure fact that I remember back in the early 80s, cocaine was not supposed to be addictive. Do you remember that? I remember that. And I'll take the comments off the
Penny, thank you for that call. Gateway drug and addiction again, Dr. Larry Bedard.
No evidence that it's a gateway drug. I think illegal drugs are gateways to other illegal drugs. And I actually learned that when I was a psychiatrist in the Navy. For example, if your son or daughter were smoking pot and they got a regular dealer, and he says, boy, let me give you a present. Let me give you a little bit of ecstasy. I like you. You know, you'll have a great time with it. And next time he said, boy, that was good. Do you have an ecstasy? He said, sure, it's $25 a tablet. What do you mean? Well, the first one's free. The second one costs you. So if you want to have drug dealers who have very little ethics, driven by the profit motive, being the ones that provide your sons and daughters with marijuana, keep it illegal. And that's going to expose them to other illegal drugs. But the World Health Organization looked at this issue, and, you know, correlation is not causality. I mean, there's 100% correlation between having milk as an infant and any kind of addiction, but it's not causative. There's no biochemical or neuroanatomy reason to say or suggest that it's a gateway drug to other drugs.
Where do you stand on that, Tim and Sermon, gateway drug question?
It's a difficult question. How would you prove that something is a gateway drug? Basically, I think you would have to find something happening in the brain which would then lead a person to be more likely to be using other drugs. And I think Dr. Bedard is basically right about that. There isn't any smoking gun there, other than the fact that once that reward center has been changed by addiction to any drug, it becomes more likely that someone can be addicted to other drugs.
Let me go to more of our callers. We'll go to Findlay, Ohio, and welcome Brian on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
Yeah, I have a comment about the made earlier by the gentleman that's the president of the Addiction Society or whatever it is in California. I'm a marijuana user and have been for years, and I've had problems with other drugs as well. But I found from my personal experience when marijuana wasn't available, then I went to other drugs. And so actually it's an anti-gateway drug, at least for me. You know, in other words,
if marijuana is a prophylactic to other drugs.
I'm saying that if I have it, then I don't even look for or want the other drugs. But whenever it's not available, then I have in the past, I've used other things that are much more harmful, you know, heroin and cocaine. And I'm not saying drugs in general are good, but I think that marijuana is pretty innocuous. And I think that, you know, certainly if that's available and that will prevent you from using something else, I think, and, you know, that's a kind of a benefit in a way.
Well, what about that argument, Dr. Cermak? You know, marijuana, a lot less harmful, perhaps, than other harder drugs, and therefore people who use marijuana may not use those harder drugs?
That's the harm reduction model, and in many cases I think it is accurate. I would prefer someone using marijuana to using IV heroin or even being thoroughly addicted to alcohol, because there will be fewer negative effects as a result of that. On the other hand, we know that people who are stopping their alcohol consumption, those who continue smoking cigarettes have a higher rate of relapse on their alcohol. So the question would be, if you are addicted to anything, whether or not you're going to lower your risks the most by getting off of everything or getting to a drug which is less harmful. And it's different for different people.
Let me read some of the emails that are coming in here. Here's Brian, who says, never a single death by marijuana, not one. Think about that. Alcohol, tens of thousands. Tobacco, 450,000. Prescription, I think it means prescription drugs, taken correctly, 1 to 200,000. Marijuana, not one. Zero, not one. Another listener says, I'm wondering why the default argument for legalization proponents is always alcohol is worse. That alcohol is bad does not mean marijuana is good. This is a fallacy of logic. And another listener, Adriana, says, please ask your guests to discuss the effects on the lungs of smoking marijuana. Most of the discussion one hears is about addiction and effects on the brain, but never about the effects of the smoking itself. For example, is the smoke carcinogenic? How does it compare to smoking cigarettes? Well, we've touched on this to some extent. Dr. Bedard, you want to weigh in here?
Once again, I think there are studies that show it's not carcinogenic, does not cause lung cancer. Talking about other medical issues, I had the opportunity to sit on a national advisory council on violence against women, and I got very involved in domestic violence, another health problem associated with alcohol, a lot more violence with alcohol, very little correlation between domestic violence and marijuana. At a recent national conference of emergency physicians, I asked a lot of my colleagues, if you had a magic drug that can convert every alcoholic to marijuana dependency, would you administer it? And 100% would do it. You know, but I also think the argument, gee, just because alcohol is bad or real health problems, that therefore justifies legalizing marijuana. Where they've done it, in Netherlands, the use rate there is half of what it is in the United States. They legalized all drugs in Portugal in 2001, and heroin dependency dropped 40%. And the way you do this is you education and treatment as opposed to criminalize people and ostracize them. So I think legalization, where it's been tried, has actually decreased usage not only of marijuana but of many other hard drugs such as heroin or cocaine.
Well, here's a listener who wonders whether it's true or not, and I've heard this before. Maybe somebody out there knows, maybe one of you knows, that the American distillers and brewers lobbies were the ones that pressed for marijuana to be a Schedule I drug. That's a fact to check. And then she writes, adolescent alcohol use also leads more often to dependency than does alcohol use begun in adult years, but no one is presently calling for alcohol to become a Schedule I drug. And perhaps a question for you, Dr. Cermak, from a listener who writes, do most educators see marijuana use as improving or worsening school performance? Which educators are encouraging their students to smoke marijuana? Well, I don't know if we have the answers to those, but what about school performance in marijuana? What do we know?
Two things. One is that if you smoke 100 times, now 100 times is not that many if you're an adolescent. If you smoke once every weekend for 2 years or twice on a weekend for 1 year, that equals 100 times. And if you do that, you are 5.8 times more likely to leave school. You are 3.3 times less likely to go to college. You are 4.5 times less likely to graduate from college. Educational achievement, diminished educational achievement, is in some ways the number one problem that we find with adolescents. And one of the reasons for that is that when adolescents stop smoking, compared to adults, we can follow the cognitive deficits, and in adults, they will clear within just a few days. In adolescents, they can be measured for as long as a month.
Because the brain's still developing, right?
The brain is still developing, and that means the natural cannabinoid system within the brain is also developing. There are different concentrations of the receptor sites and the anandamide, which is the natural cannabinoid, different concentrations at the end of the development than there are shortly after puberty. So there's a natural development that's going on, even of our cannabinoid system.
You have no quarrel with this, Larry Bedard? Or want to talk about the effect upon young people with respect to their education?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, I'll accept your numbers as accurate, but correlation does not mean causality. For example, we know that heroin dependency is related to the age at which you start drinking alcohol. So if you're 12 or 13, but then maybe if you're drinking at 12 or 13, it's because your father's a heroin addict, beating the crap out of your mother, slapping you around. So I think to look at these studies, you would have to do something in depth. Were there other problems in the family, you know, or other issues, somebody wanting, you know, gay and not being able to deal with that issue? So you would have to look before you can say this correlation is really causality. I think it does cause short-term memory loss. Once again, I would not advocate its use in adolescence. And, you know, Proposition 19 prohibits it at school, prohibits speaking in front of adolescents, and you're not allowed to use or possess it until you're 21.
Let me go to more of our callers. And from Martinez, we'll welcome Luce. Good morning.
Good morning. My question has to do with the correlation between marijuana use and schizophrenia, especially in adolescents who have a family history of it. I also would like a comment on the decreasing motivation factor. So I'll take my answer up here.
Okay, we thank you for Tim and Cermak. Correlation of schizophrenia, and how does it affect motivation?
We have some excellent studies in Sweden that followed over 20,000 conscripts into the army, in the Netherlands, thousands of people, conscripts in the army. What we know is that the natural rate of schizophrenia is probably about 1% worldwide in different populations. And this is close to doubled among people who are early smokers of marijuana. Not only is the incidence doubled, but the first break of the schizophrenia happens earlier.
And motivation?
Motivation. I find that to be an interesting one. I don't know exactly how to measure motivation. I think that the way I look at that is that our sense of novelty is under biochemical control. And when you increase the cannabinoid stimulation in the brain, everything becomes novel. A trip down the hallway to the bathroom is an adventure. And the problem is that when the receptor sites in that area of the brain are reduced, then when the THC wears off, then nothing is novel. Everything is a bit boring, and you can get into this roller coaster.
Well, I can tell you just anecdotally, you see a lot of kids who are heavy pot users who seem pretty much tuned out and not to be motivated. And we're talking about kids again. But then you see occasional pot user who's very well motivated. I mean, it seems to be a whole continuum. Dr. Bedard?
I had a daughter that was a track star, basically, at Marin, was a champion 3 years in a row. And one of the reasons I got involved in this campaign, I asked her, do you have any friends that have, you know, marijuana cards? And, oh, Dad, yeah. I mean, captain of the football team, the number two player on the tennis team. And she had 20 or 30 people she knew that had recommendations. I mean, they were the healthiest people I knew. And I think parents in Marin, if your kid is smoking, you probably want to educate them to do it responsibly or not do it. But for $100, get a recommendation. It's like an insurance policy, so you don't have to spend $10,000, you know, in the legal system to get your kid off if they get nailed without a card. So I was surprised at the student leaders at Redwood High School that have cards.
Let me get Lee on here. And Lee, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you, Michael. And I hope I can say this on the air, but looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night at Booksmith on Hate, if I can say that.
You can say that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Just quickly, I just want to say that I don't think it's no longer a shadow drug. I think people are going to smoke it anyway. If we can tax it and, you know, make some money from it, take those dollars away from the drug dealers. I know many professionals, including myself, who smoke it. I've smoked marijuana with everyone from filmmakers who make $40 million movies to doctors. So, again, I don't think it's teenagers, you know, listening to, you know, indie rock in their parents' basement. They're not the only ones smoking it. I think adults smoke it. And, again, if we can tax it and, you know, make it get out of the shadows, because people are going to do it anyway.
Okay. We thank you for the call. That's really an endorsement for Prop 19. We're going to get another caller who's going to talk again about addiction. And Carol, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. thanks for having me. I wanted to say that I'm a marijuana addict. I started when I was 13. I'm 33 now. I've been sober for 1 year, and through the help of Marijuana Anonymous, I just wanted to let people know that Marijuana Anonymous exists. There's many chapters in the Bay Area, and when I started, when I was 13, I was very depressed, and I basically suffered depression for most of the time I was smoking, and I thought that I was alleviating it, but actually when I stopped is when it started to be alleviated. So it's kind of one of those things people tell you, oh, it's causing depression, and you don't believe them until you stop. So I wanted to talk about that and just say that for many people it is very addictive, whether it's physical or mental. It's definitely an addiction, and it also caused me to be sick a lot in terms of bronchial and lowered my immune system. Thanks.
Okay, we thank you for the call. Larry Bedard, response to that call.
Well, I had another teenage daughter who said, gee, Dad, everybody drinks. So I came up with the 50-80-10-10 rule. In reality, not everybody drinks. Less than 50% of people over the age of 21 drink. People don't drink for religious reasons, health reasons, or whatever. You legalize marijuana, 100% of the people aren't. In fact, right now, 42% have tried it at one time. You mentioned earlier that 80% of the people who drink do so responsibly. They enjoy it. They like wine or relax with a cocktail. And I think the same thing would happen with marijuana. 10% of people who have alcohol are addicted, have cirrhosis of the liver, pancreatitis, seriously ill. And I think you're going to have 10% of people who would abuse marijuana and perhaps sit around and do much else, and then maybe have another 10% of people who would drive and do something irresponsible or reckless, and the same thing with alcohol. So you have about 80% of people use it responsibly. Of the 50% that do, 80% will use it responsibly.
You had a comment from you, Tim and Sermick?
Well, this is one of my points here, is that if we choose, or if the voters choose to legalize this, they're doing it because they're choosing the pleasure that they will be able to get from smoking and not being subject to any legal enforcement. I believe that if that's the way we go, we have the responsibility to deal with the collateral damage. That if we make it more available, there will be a small percentage of people who are more likely to experience significant difficulties from it. And so the first funds that come from it ought to go for treatment.
And we go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to Tampa, Florida. Chris, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you for having me. And I'm certainly not here to advocate one way or the other. I did use in college where I maintained my status on the dean's list, so I hesitate to believe that it's a demotivating drug. But again, I'm not here to advocate one way or the other. Once I graduated college, it was pretty easy to walk away from it, and I haven't looked back since. But my real question or comment is, why not just reclassify it as a Schedule II drug? That way universities can actually begin the process of researching these drugs so that we don't have anecdotal scare tactics. And I apologize if my language comes across as inflammatory or leading one way or the other, but why not actually put science to this crop?
Well, I think it's a reasonable suggestion, Larry Bedard.
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Marinol, based on 6 studies, which is synthetic THC, is a Schedule III drug. I'm a delegate to the California Medical Association, and first week in October, the California Medical Association is going to set up a task force to look at rescheduling marijuana to the appropriate category. You got 14 states where physicians can recommend it, and I know physicians in the emergency department have been asked by patients, but they hesitated to make a recommendation even when it was indicated because it's a Schedule I drug that has, quote, no known medical benefits and is high risk. The potential for abuse. It has clearly known medical benefits, and I don't think it has a high risk of abuse.
There should have been clinical trials, and there should have been research with cannabis and its effect years and years ago. I mean, we're in the dark ages still. Let me thank the caller. In fact, here's some listeners who want to weigh in. Antonia writes, I'm 65, been smoking almost daily for 30 years, run my own business successfully, don't smoke cigarettes, drink occasionally, eat healthy and exercise. There's a difference between use and abuse. I'm not a criminal. I'm a productive, responsible citizen. It's not a problem for the responsible. And another listener says, has the analysis been done on how many additional road fatalities could be caused by drivers under the influence? Well, there have been, again, varying analyses, but this listener, Greg, goes on to say, I agree that it may be less toxic than nicotine and have medicinal benefits, but why should marijuana get a fast track by the people of California without having to go through the same clinical trials as a life-saving cancer drug? Dave writes, I'm wondering if any of the few adverse reactions can be avoided in the future due to improved quality once this drug is decriminalized. Can questionable sources be partially to blame, that is, lacing or contaminants? What about that, Tim and Cermak?
That's someone who's thinking more in terms of the botany than the neuroscience. The neuroscience tells us that we have this fundamental system in our brain which uses a cannabinoid-like molecule, and that system is involved in regulating virtually every physiological function in our body. So the purer, the stronger the marijuana becomes, the more effectively we interact with that system. So a lot of what we're dealing with here is the result of effectively unbalancing that system in the brain.
But there is, go ahead, yeah, Larry Bedard.
I mean, I think you make a really good case for regulation. As I mentioned, there were 181 admissions. They didn't really sort out the data, but I know some every physician's ever admitted to patients I knew is because they were taking an edible or something oral. And you go into a marijuana dispensary and they'll have one brownie and they'll say two doses, similar size brownie and they'll say three doses. Doses for whom? A 110-pound woman or a 240-pound man? So I think when you regulate it, that would be very helpful information to say this edible, like any other drug, like aspirin. You know, it's 81 milligrams. It should say it has 25 milligrams of THC in it. And I think that's the benefit of regulations. Right now, it's even though it's legal medicinally, it's not regulated at all like a medicine.
And we go to more calls. Gregory joins us from Woodside. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to say that, you know, I've not been a user, and I've seen it active users in their households and how their kids have to deal with their parents' emotional problems that basically stem from the use of marijuana. And it's just really, really sad because, you know, the mother is, you know, one minute flipping out, the next minute she's cool as a, you know, tomcat, and then she just can't pull it together. And, she, you know, when you're a marijuana user, you're the last one to know the damage that you're causing to yourself. And I think that, you know, we have cigarettes. They're legal, but we have all this information about how much damage they cause. And that education has helped people make a choice, informed choice. And I think the same thing should be with marijuana, that we shouldn't just legalize it because it's, you know, legally it would help us not have to deal with all these you know, usage, but people can make a choice based on its, you know, health risk.
Thank you for weighing in with that opinion, Gregory, and appreciate hearing from you. I want to just get as many calls as we can in the time remaining, and let me get Evan on next. Evan, thanks for waiting. Join us.
I just wanted to validate what Dr. Cermak was saying. You know, I started regular pot use when I was 15, and I think that was the beginning of my downfall. It wasn't until it was cocaine and alcohol that was my problem, and it was pot that I loved. It wasn't until I was able to give up what I loved that I could go after what was killing me. And it's just my own personal experience that pot was the gateway drug, and it was the beginning of my downfall, though for years I thought it was actually helping me.
Well, we thank you for calling in and letting us know what you've been through. Getting a lot of personal testimony here this morning. And Sarah, can we make it fast with you? Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say a couple of things. And the first thing is that just in response to the last couple of people that called, I am a parent. I am an excellent parent. I'm a professional. I graduated cum laude from my university. And I am using it responsibly, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with that if every once in a while you smoke pot like you might have a drink or a couple drinks out with friends. And not everybody that uses it is a villain or a bad parent or a bad person.
No, you're using it responsibly, and I think that's what both our guests this morning are advocating, if somebody's going to use it at all. I want to get Laura on next. Laura, join us. Hi.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very anxious to see the ongoing research in the neuroscience, and in particular how marijuana changes neurons and, like we've been talking about, those neural connectors. So, for instance, with all these neurodegenerative disorders like Parkinson's, Huntington's, Alzheimer's, what are the connections? What's the possibility? And about dosage, et cetera, I'm very concerned because I do have a very young brother I take care of who's got Parkinson's, whose neurologist recommends marijuana. Now, here's the deal. He gets some relief on the large muscle area, but on all the other issues of cognition, memory, and other kinds of problems, it only exasperates with insomnia and other sleep disorders his problems. So I think that we don't know much, and we need to learn a lot more.
You want to come in? Here's Tim and Cermak.
That's what's been shown in multiple sclerosis, too. Some of the twitching of multiple sclerosis is helped. The motor part is helped. But cognitively, people who use marijuana actually decline a little bit faster. But the bottom line here is that we have a massive number of really valuable medications that are going to come out of being able to manipulate this molecule and make it in a way that it is more targeted and has fewer side effects.
I just did a whole event on stem cell research with the Gladstone Institute, and that's all pretty promising too. But Larry Bedard, you want to get in here on this?
Well, I think she makes an excellent point, is we need a lot more scientific studies on marijuana or cannabis or THC. It's been shown, for example, in AIDS neuropathy to have some unique properties. But since it's a Scheduled I drug, there's only been 20 double-blind scientific studies done on the medicinal use of marijuana. And I think it has a lot of potential, and we might also find out that it interacts with other drugs you shouldn't use, but we need to have a lot more science on this very valuable plant.
There's a good and very important note to end on. I think despite the disagreements that we have, we're all in agreement of the fact that there is a need for more research and more discovery, more study. Thank you both. I want to thank Dr. Larry Bedard, who's a Marin-based physician, former president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, and Tim and Cermak, president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine. Thanks also to our reporter, Michael Montgomery, who was with us earlier. Another hour of Forum up ahead. Thanks to senior editor Dan Zoll and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, again, we appreciate your being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.